they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeese.
And Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, SoundCloud, MixCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play, or you can find us on popularresistance.org. And while you're there, check out our store where you'll find t-shirts, tote bags, bumper stickers, and water bottles. So today we interviewed Bahman Azad. He's the organizational secretary of the U.S. Peace Council and also was one of the organizers with us of the People's Mobilization in New York City.
Yeah, Bahman's a great ally. We've worked with him on the No Bases Coalition. He's also one of the co-chairs of the effort to defend the embassy protectors, which is getting people mobilized and involved in our federal case that we're facing from that Venezuela embassy event.
That's right. That's defendembassyprotectors.org. And we're also using it as a way to continue to advocate to stop the unilateral coercive measures and regime change efforts and threats of military aggression towards Venezuela,
which are escalating under Trump, even after John Bolton.
Right. So we talked with Bahman about kind of this past week, the UN session and the people's mobilization that went on in New York City, the purpose of it and kind of what came out of it. So stick around for that interview. But quickly, while we're mentioning Venezuela, one thing that came out of the United Nations session is that the United States was not able to achieve what it wanted when it came to Venezuela.
That's right. At the General Assembly, they hoped to have the General Assembly recognize Juan Guaido and his fake government, but that didn't even happen. They didn't even broach it because they don't have the votes. The overwhelming support for President Maduro's government is evident. The 50 countries who are allied with the U.S. are weakening. Some are talking to Maduro behind the scenes. It's just an unrealistic idea to call Guaido the president of Venezuela. And the General Assembly knows it. They know the U.S. is making up this fictional president.
Right. And that's why it was the Maduro government's representatives who were in the United Nations this week, as well as Vice President Delcy Rodriguez Gomez, who gave the address to the UN General Assembly. However, Guaido's people were still in New York over the weekend trying to get what they could get. The UN General Secretary refused to meet with them, but the United States did pledge to give them $52 million more in aid for groups inside of Venezuela to try to build the opposition there.
That's what's one of the examples of how the coup attempt continues and how even with the exit of John Bolton, who had been the person in charge of Venezuela in the Trump administration, his leaving did not end that. In fact, it's escalated. That's one example. Also turning the OAS rules into an attempt to threaten military action against Venezuela is another example. And I'll say on Delcy Rodriguez, the vice president, boy, she is an impressive person. You can really see when people like her step up and when the foreign minister steps up and the U.S. UN, the Venezuelan ambassador to the UN gets speaking, that this is a very deep government. This is not a Maduro government. This is a Venezuelan government.
Right.
And the Venezuelan government has a lot of talented people involved, has a lot of excellent social movements throughout the country supporting it. Getting rid of Maduro will not get rid of the Bolivarian process. That will continue beyond Maduro. And I expect after his term is up, we'll see a new president because Venezuela is a democratically run government.
That's right. And this past week, the United Nations Human Rights Council passed a resolution recognizing that the unilateral coercive measures against Venezuela are causing problems for its people. And at the same time, the UN also agreed to investigate what's going on in Venezuela. Now, we know the last time that a UN representative, Michelle Bachelet, who's the head of the Human Rights Council, visited Venezuela, her report was very biased and didn't mention anything about the unilateral coercive measures. Hopefully with this new investigation, they'll be able to get the truth about, you know, in an unbiased way about what's going on there.
Well, Bachelet really showed her bias. She is a neoliberal politician, allied with neoliberal movements throughout Latin America. And so it's not surprising to reach that result in the last time the Human Rights Council looked at it, but she got a lot of pushback. People called her out for her totally false reporting. And so hopefully this time she will have learned a lesson that she can't get away with putting out misinformation the way she did last time.
Right. Now let's talk about some news closer to home. There was a bill that passed the House with widespread support last week, the Marijuana Safe Banking Act. Why don't you talk about what that is and why it's important?
That is the first time ever that a marijuana law reform bill has gotten to either floor of Congress. That was the House chamber that it went to. It had mass support, bipartisan support. It was a landslide victory. What this law will allow is safe banking, which means that banks, which right now are forbidden from being involved with marijuana sales, will be allowed to be involved. And that means that this cash business will be able to put their cash into a bank, which is much safer for everybody and much better for the businesses as well as society at large. So it was a major support. What's interesting about it is it's not just the traditional marijuana movement that's pushing this, but now the banking industry and the insurance industry are seeing the value of this. Of course, the banking industry sees this as a multi-billion dollar market that's growing quickly. It'll be a multi-tens of billion dollar market as it continues to grow, and they want to have a piece of the action. So they want to provide banking, and I think the government realizes that it's much better to regulate the commercial transactions rather than allow them to be unregulated, totally cash transaction business.
Right. And so what's next if this passes through the Senate? There's more that the marijuana reform movement is pushing for. What's the next thing that's on their list?
Well, first, it looks good in the Senate. I think it's important to say that. The chairman of the Banking Committee and Mitch McConnell seem to be supportive. Donald Trump has not said anything against it. So it looks like this has Republican support in the Senate and the presidency. So we may see this become law under Donald Trump's presidency and under a Republican Senate. That'd be amazing. But there's a broader bill that will deal with marijuana legalization, adult legal use of marijuana. It would declassify marijuana, so it's no longer part of the Controlled Substances Act. That will greatly free up research on its medical uses and other health issues around marijuana, and it would allow states to really move forward. I think just this banking act alone will result in a lot more states moving forward. But if we move toward adult legal use on the federal level, remove those barriers, then you'll see many states do this because it just makes sense. Everywhere that marijuana legalization has been tried, it's resulted in all positive outcomes. No increase in use, no sign of driver's accidents. In fact, reductions of people dying in driver's accidents, reduction in arrests, reduction in law enforcement costs.
Reduction in teen use.
And major increases in tax revenue.
Right.
And every state is struggling with lack of tax revenue. So this is a winner for the states. And if the federal government gets out of the way and the Safe Banking Act will be a step toward that, I expect to see many more states move toward adult legal use of marijuana.
Let's talk about the climate strike. So the climate strike was actually a week of action from September 20th to the 27th. On the 20th of September, there were estimated more than 4 million people came out worldwide. And on this past Friday, the 27th, that number was more than 6 million.
And this is the largest global demonstration since opposition to the Iraq war. And so that's a major achievement for the organizers to get that many people out. And I think everybody involved knows that this is just not a march. That's not the way we're going to solve this crisis. We have to do much more than march. A march is a nice action to show public support, to show national consensus, indeed global consensus on the need to confront climate change. That's a critical ingredient to making change, but much more is needed, and people know that. And so this is just one action of many that's going to be necessary to confront the climate crisis.
Right. So those took place all around the world, but closer to our home, there were students in Montgomery County who took it to their school board.
That's Montgomery County, Maryland.
That's right. And they were protesting, calling on their school board to make concrete changes in the school system, reducing their carbon footprint. And then in Washington, D.C., on the 20th, there was a major action, or I guess it was the 23rd on Monday, a major action where they shut down 22 intersections. On Friday, they returned with a large march that wound its way through Washington, D.C., snarling traffic and, again, raising awareness. We have a climate emergency and something needs to be done about it.
And declaring when there's an emergency, it cannot be business as usual. And that's what shutting down the streets does. It shows no business as usual. We must confront this emergency that is already having tremendous negative impacts throughout the United States and the world.
Right. In other parts of the country this past week, activists took it right to the source of the fossil fuels. So in New Hampshire, in Bow, New Hampshire, they had the largest action, that climate action that's been there since the 1970s when the Clamshell Alliance actions were going on. Hundreds of people rallied and then marched to the Merrimack Station, a coal-fired power plant, where they protested at the main gates and some went into the power plant. Their plan was to try to start taking the coal away. They don't want it to be used or burned. And 67 people were arrested in that action.
We need those kinds of confrontational actions, and we know they're continuing throughout the country.
Right. And then in the Mountain Valley Pipeline in Southern Virginia, a raging granny, 75-year-old Duff Benjamin, locked herself down to a piece of pipeline equipment and stopped construction for 5 hours. Meanwhile, in Duluth, Minnesota, hundreds of people gathered on the shores of Lake Superior and protested Line 3, another pipeline that they've been working actively to prevent from going through, but the company is still moving forward despite the fact that it doesn't have all the permits.
And these protests make a difference because they add to the time, the delay, the cost of an industry that really is pretty fragile economically. The fracking industry is not looking good economically, and so these protests actually do make a big difference.
Right. Now, around the world, there are some very serious protests going on in a number of countries calling for their leaders to step down or calling for independence. So in Egypt, where the Arab Spring, Egypt was a big part of the Arab Spring back in 2011, even though protest is pretty much illegal there, over 1,000 people took this to the streets in Cairo and other cities calling for the president, Sisi, to step down.
And Sisi is a very aggressive dictator, basically, who arrests media at a very high level, arrests activists at a very high level. And so for these protesters, 1,000 of them to get active like this is a very positive step. We'll see if this continues to grow like the Arab Spring did. Tahrir Square 2.0.
Right. Well, they're facing very serious corruption in the Sisi government, as well as the impacts of some intermonetary fund loans that have actually been causing poverty to increase. So they're having a direct impact on people in Egypt. That's why they're coming out. Hundreds of people were arrested. And as you said, reporters were arrested as well. In West Papua, people are continuing to protest for their right to have a vote on whether they want to be independent or not, something that was promised to them in the New York Agreement.
And that's a long-term story. That New York agreement was decades ago.
Right, in the 1960s.
And so they're still fighting for that. And that kind of persistence is an essential ingredient to their what will be their ultimate victory. They will become a decolonized country.
Well, in the meantime, the Indonesian police are acting in a very aggressive and violent way. They opened fire on students there in the protest this past week. There's estimated maybe as many as 40 people that were killed that because of that, as well as scores of people that were injured. So, you know, this is something that the West Papuans have a right to, and they shouldn't have to face this sort of violence to have that right fulfilled. And also there's been, you know, quite a media blockade on what's happening in West Papua. So it's important for us to spread the word.
That's why we report
that.
On it.
Right. And then in Haiti, you know, there's been a lot of unrest going on this year in Haiti, especially around corruption of the president Jovenel Moise and what he did with the money from the Petrocaribe. But there were there are ongoing protests in Port-au-Prince with blocking, you know, streets with all kinds of materials. Those two have also turned violent. They're facing very severe shortages of food and fuel in Haiti.
And this Haiti conflict, this uprising continues the long-term synergy between Venezuela and Haiti, going back to Simon Bolivar, going back to Hugo Chavez. And now these protests were sparked by the U.S.-picked president of Haiti going to the OAS and being a critical vote for recognizing Juan Guaido. That's really what kicked off a lot of these protests.
Right. Well, I mean, going back to, what was it, 1804, when Haiti was the first successful slave uprising and gaining their independence.
And they've been punished ever since.
Right. Let's talk about something that's really in the news right now, although it's interesting the way that it's being spun, and that is the news that came out recently about an intelligence whistleblower who was very concerned about a phone call that President Trump made.
Yeah, that has been a really interesting and rapid rise. Of course, I think that impeachment has been something that has been ready to boil over for a long time in the Democratic Party. There have always been advocates for impeaching Donald Trump on a whole range of issues, but this telephone call between President Trump and President Zelensky over the summer after the recent legislative elections in Ukraine really resulted in the impeachment floodgates being burst open. And it's because in that phone call, even though we haven't actually gotten a transcript of the call, we got a summary of the call. In that phone call, it's evident that over and over again, Trump was coercing, urging, demanding that Zelensky and Ukraine investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's role in an energy company in Ukraine.
Well, when you say coercing, he was threatening to withhold military funding that the U.S. has been providing to Ukraine and also refusing a meeting with Zelensky unless he acquiesced. Is this unusual?
It's very unusual. Well, I was going to say it's unusual, but you know, really the U.S. mode of operation around the world is to be dominant, to use both bribes and threats to get what it wants. And it's not even unusual in Ukraine. One of the things that's interesting about this issue is it could also be called Bidengate, because it's evident that Joe Biden, he proudly talked about how he used his political pressure to remove a prosecutor. And he threatened to not approve a $1 billion IMF loan. He claims that he was in Ukraine and for a 6-hour visit, and he told the president that if that prosecutor was not removed before he left, there would be no IMF loan. That $1 billion would not go to Ukraine. People in Ukraine say this is actually, well, it's a little bit not accurate story. He did threaten, and he did threaten during that trip, but it was a multi-month long series of threats from the Obama administration and from Joe Biden. Why? Well, there's two stories about this. The story that the Biden side is trying to get out is that the prosecutor, Shokin, was not doing his job, that he was not investigating corruption. Shokin and many people in Ukraine are saying, in fact, he was investigating the gas company on whose board Hunter Biden sits. There's no allegation that he was investigating Hunter Biden, but he was investigating that company. And the prosecutor general who Biden fired, he put out an affidavit in another case in the last few weeks where he described how there had been no complaints against him. There was no talk about him being fired. But Poroshenko said to him, he's being fired because of Joe Biden. Joe Biden's threats, and because of the investigation in the gas company. And so
now, didn't Joe Biden use something as a stick in that as well?
Well, the $1 billion IMF loan.
Right.
And so, yes, the whole threats and promises of reward, it's carrots and sticks, is the U.S. method of operation. And so it's interesting that both Biden and Trump kind of used the same mode of operation. They threatened and promised, but as Trump says, it requires Ukraine to play ball with the U.S. And so this is all put in the context of the most overt and open coup of the United States that occurred during the Obama-Biden-Clinton administration.
Right. It doesn't quite match the coup in Venezuela where they just didn't even bother to have an election.
Well, I guess that's true. This it was the most open coup until Venezuela.
Right.
But in the Obama era, Victoria Nuland was an assistant secretary of state. Mm-hmm. As the protests were going on, she spoke to a business conference, a Ukrainian-sponsored business conference, about how the U.S. has spent $5 billion in 5 years working to get Ukraine into the EU-US orbit. And the previous president came out in favor of staying out of the EU and instead working with Russia and being part of a commonwealth of non-aligned countries. And so that is what led to the coup attempt. Then the $5 billion that the U.S. has been spending was showing itself, because that money was used to build an opposition, a anti-Russia opposition, a pro-EU opposition in Ukraine. And it resulted in this maiden protest, which were pretty dramatic protests.
And part of that opposition was neo-Nazis.
Heavily neo-Nazi. In fact, the neo-Nazis really pushed it over the edge. There had been protests going on, but when they started to get violent neo-Nazis involved from the western part of Ukraine, that really pushed it over the edge. So that was very open.
And they massacred people, and they went into politicians' offices and like physically dragged them out of their offices. They were very aggressive.
Very aggressive. So Nuland was very open about it, but she's not the only one. Well, that's not the only example of Nuland. The other example of Nuland was that she was on an open telephone call talking to the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and they were discussing, what are we going to do after the coup? Who's going to be in charge? Nuland said that Yats would be in charge, and he'd become the prime minister. In fact, he became Prime Minister Yats after the coup.
Now, who is Yats?
Yats is a long-time Ukraine politician who is allied with the European side of Ukraine politics. He is a non-believer in the Holocaust. He's allied with the fascists on Western Ukraine. He served as foreign minister as well as finance minister before becoming prime minister. He served as prime minister for 2 years after the coup. Then he created a right-wing neo-fascist party and was kicked out of the government and is no longer in government. But he served for 2 years. The other example of this coup being so open was the selection of the president, Petro Poroshenko, the candy oligarch. He was selected, and he had been for 6 years, according to WikiLeaks documents, multiple WikiLeaks documents, an ally of the United States, an informant for the CIA and State Department. He was telling the U.S. government how to proceed in Ukraine for 6 years, including talking about how important it is for the U.S. to be in Crimea. And Crimea, we know, became important because that's where the Russians have a Navy base. And Poroshenko was talking to Hillary Clinton in one of these memos about how that was so important for the U.S. to be in Crimea. Of course, in the end, Crimea voted to leave Ukraine and join Russia.
When that was happening, I remember the United States media putting out all these falsehoods about Russian tanks on the border and they were going to come in and invade, when in fact it was actually the people of Crimea who voted to join Russia because of the violence that was being perpetrated on them.
I don't think the Russians even fired a bullet in that process. So funny, this is such an open coup by the U.S., and yet in U.S. media, it's described as Russia taking over Crimea.
Right.
In reality, it was the U.S. taking over Ukraine, putting people in power who were allied with the United States, and I've just mentioned a few, there are others, and how they were going to take Crimea, the Navy base, from Russia. That was the plan. In the end, it didn't happen because Putin stood up to it. Now, Putin probably could have gotten all of Eastern Ukraine to vote to join Russia, but he didn't do that. Now, there continues to be a conflict between Eastern Ukraine and Kiev and Western Ukraine, and that's the conflict that this money that Trump held up, this money for military assistance, that Trump held up was really for this war with Eastern Ukraine and, as the U.S. likes to put it, a war with Russia.
I think it's important for people to hear this story because I remember when things were happening in Ukraine, a lot of people were buying the media line and didn't think it was a coup and thought what the U.S. was doing there was just fine. But I remember the pictures of Victoria Nuland and Joe Biden like handing out cookies to the...
Victoria Nuland and John McCain.
And John McCain, that's right.
Handing out cookies and flowers to the protesters.
Right.
John McCain joining a protest. How unusual.
You know there's something wrong with it when someone like John McCain is...
People not only bought the Ukraine story that the U.S. is putting forward, but they're buying the story today that Joe Biden was not really firing the prosecutor to protect his son's gas company, even though there's lots of documents that have come out. On popularresistance.org, we have a newsletter about this, plus other stories. If you just hit popularresistance.org/tag/Ukraine, you can see lots of stories about the whole history of Ukraine, including the most recent stories. But there have now been documents released that show that at the time that Biden was making his threats, that everyone knew this prosecutor was still investigating the Ukrainian gas company.
And it was very strange that right after the coup, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, Devin Archer, who's the college roommate of a friend of John Kerry's.
A stepson of John Kerry's. And Devin Archer was a business partner of Hunter Biden, and Devin Archer was chair of the financial committee for John Kerry's presidential campaign.
Right. There's a company that Christopher Hines, Devin Archer, and Hunter Biden are part of.
Rosemont.
And that's the company that was getting a check for $160,000+ a month from the gas company. Are they gas people?
Hunter Biden is a very sad story. I mean, he has had a difficult life with his mother and sister dying in a car accident, his brother later dying of brain cancer. So he's had a lot of losses. Plus, he has Joe Biden and his father, which can't be easy to have a senator and a vice president and presidential candidate as your father. So he's had tremendous problems with drinking, cocaine use. He was kicked out of the Navy Reserves because of a positive cocaine test. In fact, that was just about a month before he was put on the board of this Ukrainian gas company. He's had some successes in business and some failures in business, but he has no gas or oil experience that I could find. So it's very surprising he was put on this gas company's board. But I think if his name had not been Biden, he would not have gotten that appointment and he would not be getting more than $1 million in payments from that gas company.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see how things unfold as the Democrats are saying that they're going to impeach President Trump in the House. The questions are they going to try to limit this so that the facts about Joe Biden's involvement in the Ukrainian coup don't come out? It was interesting that Elizabeth Warren is now considered to be the lead candidate in the Democratic Party presidential race.
Well, Joe Biden has been fading, and I suspect that already the Ukraine gate, which also has a Biden gate piece to it, is also leading to Biden fading even further. And I think that'll be a good thing for the Democratic Party, although I'm not a Democrat, so my view doesn't matter very much. But I think there's a good chance Biden has a history of pro-war, bad on race issues, bad on the drug war, bad on student debt, bad on corporate power. I don't understand why people still support him, but he is up there in the polls. Some polls have him ahead. Some polls have him fading into second place in some states behind Bernie Sanders. So that's the three-way race, it seems like, in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. We'll see how it turns out.
Right.
One more point about Ukraine Gate. It really exposes U.S. foreign policy and its abusive coup attempts, regime change campaigns, how they are really become a quagmire that trap the United States. United States presidents should not be calling the president of Ukraine to order them to investigate a political opponent. That's plainly wrong. And the fact that it's happening is because the U.S. has taken control of Ukraine. Biden shouldn't be going to the president of Ukraine and saying, fire that prosecutor. Why is it happening? Because this was a U.S. coup. This is a U.S.-controlled government. Everywhere we've seen U.S. coups take place, going back to Iran in 1953, removing a democratically elected prime minister, up into Venezuela today, we see U.S. coup attempts, U.S. regime change campaigns cause problems for not just the United States, but for the people in those countries in very severe ways. And they become issues that we can't get rid of. We're still in conflict with Iran. If it hadn't been for that 1953 coup, we'd have a completely different relationship with Iran. We're still in conflict with Venezuela, with Nicaragua, with Cuba. You know, and look at the mess of Iraq. Iraq was a regime change program. You were Saddam Hussein. We're still stuck in Iraq. So we need to learn from Ukraine Gate that it's time to change U.S. foreign policy. We need to start our analysis with opposition to U.S. imperialism, opposition to intervention, opposition to regime change, and certainly opposition to never-ending wars.
One last thing I wanted to bring up before we go on to our interview with Bahman Azad is a letter that hundreds of organizations put out this past week to the United Nations about the role of corporations and opposition to kind of a new initiative that the United Nations has.
Yeah, well, we talked about this in the past, about the corporatizing of the UN.
The Global Redesign Initiative, and this is something that the World Economic Forum came up with back in 2010. And it was kind of this idea that countries are just really slow and clunky. They take a long time to make decisions when they use these democratic processes, and that corporations are much more agile and faster. Corporations can move their resources and their money from here to there very quickly, and that corporations needed to have a bigger role. And so their vision was really of a hybrid United Nations that was both countries, nation states, and corporations.
And it was being done very quietly. We did do a radio show on this years ago, and people can find it in the archives on popularresistance.org podcast page. But now it seems like this moved forward. It's done it pretty quietly, but it seems like this hybrid UN is becoming reality. And if it comes hybrid, that means in the end, corporate power will rule, because that means that corporations will have a role to play when UN resolutions are developed, on votes of in various committees and councils. They'll have an impact throughout the process, and that will not be good for the globe. More corporate power is the opposite of what we need. Already the UN has too much corporate influence. We need to be going the other direction and make it much more a people's UN and not a corporate UN.
Well, with that, let's get into our interview with Bahman. We'll take a short musical break, and then we'll be right back.
My name is John Riley. I'll have your ear only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. When I got to America, it was my duty to go. Enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. And it was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army, with the morals of a bayonet blade. And there amidst all these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
You're listening
side.
To Clearing the Fog, speaking the truth Patrick to expose Battalion. The forces of greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeese.
And now we turn to our guest, Bahman Azad. Bahman is a organizational secretary for the United States Peace Council and the representative of the World Peace Council to the United Nations. He's one of the main organizers of the People's Mobilization to Stop the U.S. War Machine and Save the Planet actions that occurred in New York City this past weekend. Bahman, thank you for taking time to join us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start out. The three of us were some of the organizers of this event, but on the Monday night event that we held at Community Church of New York, you really laid out so beautifully the purpose of that event, speaking about the impacts of the United States foreign policy on various countries. Would you be able to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, it's been a while. We're all aware that the United States has been on rampage with regard to, first, starting with wars since 9/11, and then expanding it. Not that they didn't have it before, but they really went on an all-out onslaught on various countries in terms of sanctions and embargoes and blockades. Of course, history of Cuba for many decades has been the case, but against Venezuela, against Iran, against Syria, and you know, recent number that they gave us actually yesterday in our meeting with the vice president of Venezuela was that 33 countries are now under U.S. unilateral coercive measures. So they are really destroying about 30% of the whole world in that way, and it has to be stopped. And they're using every trick in their bag to achieve these things. And any country that still resists, despite the measures, they intensify as they have already done it against Cuba, against Venezuela, and they're really killing people and at the same time are talking about human rights and democracy and everything and trying to bring down democratically elected leaders in these countries just because they are not falling in line with the U.S. plan for domination of the world. That has caused tremendous danger. We're all aware that unless people of the United States do something, because that's where the whole beast can be stopped, nothing is going to happen around the world because the power is so imbalanced, you know, in favor of the United States with these countries. So it's our responsibility, and that's why we came together. We have been working together for a long time, but this one was a great achievement, the People's Mobilization, to pull our forces together. And as you know, dozens of organizations were part of this, and we created these two events, the demonstration and the conference of the diplomatic corps of the United Nations. Unfortunately, many of them could not participate, and those who participated declined from speaking because of the U.S. measures against representatives at the UN, stopping their movements, blocking their movements, denying them visas, expelling them, sending them out to the country, and all those things. And it's really putting it kind of a chokehold on the United Nations and its role. So it's a multi-level struggle that we are continuing to do, and I hope that this People's Mob is the beginning of a new phase in our collective work.
That's exactly right. We need to build on that effort and make it an ongoing project. And you're also right saying that it's up to the people of the United States to stop the government of the United States, that it's very hard for people around the world to do so. You raise a lot of different issues in that opening. Let's go through some of them. Let's start with the issue of what we call in the United States economic sanctions, but many see around the world as unilateral coercive measures. Can you discuss what unilateral coercive measures are, their legality, and their impact?
Well, according to international law, the only entity that can collectively, by decision of majority, enforce economic sanctions or economic punishments or economic embargoes on countries, is the UN Security Council. And any economic measure that is unilaterally imposed by one country against another is illegal according to UN Charter. This is what the US has been doing. They couldn't get approval for many of these measures in the past, and they went on a unilateral one. Even the ones, for example, when the UN imposed a few sanctions on Iran on the nuclear issue, and Iran came to the table and signed the nuclear treaty, the US unilaterally pulled out and unilaterally expanded all those sanctions on Iran. This is called unilateral coercive measures because it is aimed at achieving political ends of one country by making life disastrous for another country until they come to their knees. I mean, the whole creation of UN was to stop such actions. And now the US is unilaterally doing all this. I mean, we all know about the casualties and the problems and hardships that the suffering that the people of Venezuela, Syria, Cuba, especially now, they shut off all their import of fuel, and they're really in a crisis, huge crisis right now. Iran, Syria, all of these countries, and these are absolutely outside of the United Nations Charter and a total violation of international law. But the idea of global domination is overriding everything else for the U.S.
What's really interesting about it is the U.S. is so open about its use of these coercive measures.
Well, we brag about it.
And that they're being used to change the governments. It's like such an open violation. We sometimes put a facade, like we say Maduro is a dictator, when in fact he won an election that was observed by 150 international election observers, found unanimously to be consistent with international law and democracy. And yet we call him a dictator to justify these false sanctions. Just recently, as you mentioned, the sanctions against Iran were increased, and they were just increased recently with this attack on the Saudi oil facility, even though Iran had nothing to do with it. Others took credit for it. No proof that Iran had anything to do it. And yet the U.S. put sanctions on because of that. So it's false basis, and its real purpose is open. And yet U.S. keeps doing it.
Well, not only that, I think that, you know, the U.S. is escalating
yes.
in its use of these things. And, you know, one of the things you brought up is that some of the members of the different diplomatic delegations that had expressed interest in participating in the people's mobilization were not able to do so because of the way the United States is treating UN representatives. Can you talk a little bit about the countries that were invited to the people's mobilization and who came and who was not able to come because of the U.S.'s actions?
Yes, we invited these countries. Of course, we wanted to invite many more, but with the time limit we have, logistical issues that we had, and the U.N. restrictions that we had, U.S. restrictions on U.N. people, we had to limit it to 6 countries, which included Bolivia, Cuba, Iran, Nicaragua, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe. Many of the countries are having problem. Even, you know, Cuba, for example, the U.S. had just expelled 2 of their diplomatic staff with the charge of influence operations, which, can you imagine? So you speak to anybody on the street, you're influencing their mind, right? So it means, in fact, shut up. If you speak, we're going to expel you. With Iran, I was told by the Syrian ambassador a while ago, Iran has been, you know, Syria, Cuba, Iran are restricted to 25 miles from the United Nations in terms of their travel, how far they can go. Well, Iran is having an extra one, which is the Iranian mission at the UN and foreign minister when he comes here and anybody else from the foreign ministry. They are restricted not only to 25 miles they were before, but they are only allowed to go from the airport to the mission to the UN and to their residence and nowhere else. That's why Iran was absent. Also, Syrian ambassador told me about 2-3 weeks ago that there is another order by the United States State Department to the Iranian mission that all of them who are living in New York area, greater New York area, must within 1 month all move their residence to Manhattan. This is the situation, right? And Venezuelans are saying that we are expecting that to happen to us too. And Syrians were saying the same thing.
Yeah, and then you add on top of that, like the sanctions against foreign ministers. The foreign minister of Iran, Zarif, was put sanctions on him, and the rationale was because he was speaking on behalf of his country. Well, what's a foreign minister supposed to do?
And on top of that, this time the United States would not allow him to visit an
That's
Iranian
right.
diplomat who's currently in the hospital in New York City being treated for cancer. And the foreign minister of Iran was prohibited from visiting him.
And then even Russians weren't even allowed to get visas. And multiple Russians were...
10. Yeah.
10 Russians were denied visas for the UN General Assembly.
You've been working with the UN for a while. Have you ever seen this level of restriction by the United States on UN delegations?
No. It is just, to me, all these ridiculous measures that U.S. is adopting and enforcing are a sign of weakness, not strength. This is the last gasp. That they're trying to do, use everything to just maintain control. And they know it. They cannot do it in normal ways anymore. So they have to resort, you know, they call it last resort, but they are at their last resort by doing all these things.
Yeah.
They're trying to save the hegemony, which is being deteriorating. And country after country after country is resisting what the U.S. is doing. And now they're pulling out the last weapon. I mean, which has become military and economic, both at the same time.
When the United States takes these kinds of desperate actions out of insecurity, because U.S. hegemony is weakening, their dollar domination is weakening, U.S. empire is weakening, they're pulling out of various international agreements, all these are such self-defeating actions. What do you think about the impact of these actions at the UN, which are so unusual in our history, in UN history? Is that a chance this could lead to the UN being moved out of the United States? Is that being talked about?
Yes, glad you asked that, because that was one of the discussions we had with the Venezuelan vice president yesterday. And actually, the UN ambassador for Venezuela gave a very elaborate response to it. The gist of the argument, because I raised the question, okay, what can we do about this? Should the UN be moved out of the United States? And actually, they said the U.S. is itching for that to happen because they would immediately withdraw from the U.N. They said, go ahead.
If the U.N. is funded in large part, U.S. puts a lot of money into it, often uses that as a bargaining chip to keep control.
Yes.
The issue is, will this diplomatic abuse by the United States continue to rise to such a level where people around the world say, it's not worth it. Fine, let the U.S. leave the U.N. We're not enforcing international law anyway. And that was one of the whole point of the conference that we held in New York. The peace is through upholding the U.N. charter, but it's not being upheld. And so we're in this kind of predicament. Do we push and the U.S. then says, we're not going to be part of international law, or do we let the U.S. continue to abuse international law?
Well, the trend has been for the U.S. to gradually replace U.N. with NATO as the main force of exerting its power. They have been twisting arms. They've been threatening with financial punishment and all those to get votes at the U.N., and that's why they have in many ways crippled U.N. in its actual mission. And they took control of the Security Council. We know that. Before this, I've been studying, and I actually wrote an unpublished paper on the history of veto in the United Nations Security Council. And it is interesting that at the beginning of the start of the UN, it was mostly Soviet Union that was doing the block, the veto. And US had all the other countries behind it to get resolutions passed. And it was Soviet Union that was doing the vetoing. And as we go through time, through decades, you will see that balance is shifting. And towards the end, until the collapse of Soviet Union, it is the US doing the most of the veto, because now the other side had the majority support. And you could see even the non-aligned movement, all the other movements within the UN was shifting the balance of forces against the US in the United Nations. And it seems they have realized that they can only maintain it either by force, as they are doing it right now, or getting out and acting, not that they are openly doing unilaterally everything they want to do, to just go ahead and do it officially and use NATO and the coalition of the willing that started with the Iraq war instead of going through the UN. And they are ready to do that.
So if the UN moved out of the United States, if the United States left the United Nations, then really kind of the largest international bodies would be NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and the non-aligned movement.
Well, the UN would still exist.
Right.
In the UN.
Right. But in terms of the...
So that's an interesting conflict, isn't it?
The forces that would be in play. Now, the non-aligned movement is over 120 countries. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. This emerged as a result of during the Cold War, that there were countries that didn't want to be under the influence of the United States, and the big military camps decided to get together and form this non-aligned movement that is independent from both sides of the Cold War. And they have done tremendous work in terms of defending the sovereignty of the countries and all that. But, again, like the UN, the non-aligned movement has always been under pressure since the dismantling of the USSR, because the balance of forces that allowed it to operate effectively has shifted in favor of the United States. And now a lot of countries within the non-aligned movement are under direct U.S. pressure to be silent, go along with the U.S. I was really impressed by what happened in Venezuela in terms of their political resolution, which was a fantastic document in support of the sovereignty of nations and territorial integrity. But the question of enforcement is another thing, because when you want to implement those decisions, the countries in the non-aligned movement, they are afraid of the United States, especially the smaller ones, that the U.S. can pressure. And that's why I think that non-aligned movement on its own cannot be the substitute for the U.N., although it's the majority of the countries, all of the countries outside the U.S. camp. Anybody else outside NATO is non-aligned movement, part of non-aligned movement. And in that sense, but the thing is, it's a question of resources, enforcement, balance of power. So in my view, yes, the threat of moving out of the United States should be kept on But at the same time, the mission should be protecting the UN and reviving it.
Right. So
back to original mission. So defending the UN Charter is, I think, one of the most important elements in the struggle that we have.
That's what the point of our event was, that the path to peace was through enforcement of the UN Charter. And that's being violated by the United States primarily on almost a daily basis.
And that's why we launched the Global Appeal, is to really start bringing people from organizations and individuals from countries around the world together to start building a transnational structure, popular movement structure to complement the non-aligned movement.
And that's the Global Appeal for Peace.net, Global Appeal number 4, Peace.net. And people can go there, sign up, and get involved in that ongoing project to build an international, transnational movement to push for peace through upholding international law. Now, you mentioned the Caracas Declaration. That was this summer by the non-aligned movement. So the non-aligned movement has really kind of become reactivated in the face of all these U.S. attacks. And I think, you know, we talk about NATO as the alternative to the U.N., but NATO's under a lot of stress too. I mean, the NATO countries are, it's not as solid an organization as it seems. There's a lot of conflict within NATO, a lot of fissures in NATO, a lot of fights over money. It's expanding now to Colombia and to talking about Brazil, which is a really strange expansion. They're continuing to surround the Russian southern borders, causing more stress. So the United States putting all its eggs in the NATO basket is a pretty fragile choice for the United States. So I could see at the same time we're pushing to build the UN and uphold the UN Charter, we should also continue to push against NATO. And we've all worked on that issue as well with a No to NATO protest earlier this year. Talk about NATO a little bit.
Well, of course, NATO is fractured. No question about it. This was built around the idea of maintaining U.S. hegemony on the Western front against Soviet Union. And all of these countries are at the mercy of the United States. If you remember the history of it, the U.S. was responsible for protecting all of these countries militarily. And that was enough with the so-called threat of Cold War and Soviet Union threat. These countries submitted to the will of the United States within the UN just to be protected. And the fear was created artificially. But at the same time, Europeans didn't dare oppose the United States so long as Soviet Union existed. But with the Soviet Union gone, this U.S. hegemony inside the UN is also being challenged. NATO is not necessarily cooperating, I mean, the rest of the NATO, with the U.S. in everything U.S. wants to do. And you see it in the responses of the European Union a little bit, that they are distancing in here and there from what the U.S. is doing. And if you remember, starting with the Iraq War, France vetoed Security Council resolution for U.S. to attack Iraq. So the signs are there. It's being fractured. But there's a difference between NATO and U.N. in terms of as a collective of countries, is that NATO is built specifically around maintaining U.S. hegemony, which was not the purpose of the UN. So it's not an alternative to the UN. It's going to be just gunslingers being free to do it without the sheriff around if NATO takes over. And it seems that the U.S. is not, you know, it's unilateralism that started with George W. Bush within NATO even, and kind of downplayed a little bit by during Obama administration, going back to the principle of collective domination, is being reversed again by Trump. Back to the unilateralist approach. And there's a lot of pundits in the ruling circles that are even advocating it nowadays. And so it's a very dangerous time that, you know, yes, NATO has its own internal problems, but I cannot imagine anybody can survive the world without the UN and with NATO being dominating the world.
Well, you know, a UN without the United States, the Security Council would probably take a lot different actions that without the U.S. veto. And if it would become a counterbalance to NATO and I think cause further fracturing in NATO. The United States is able to do this because after World War II, it was the kind of the standing survivor. China was not developed yet. Russia had been destroyed. Europe had been destroyed. The U.S. had the big economy and big military, only one with nuclear weapons at the time. And so it was dominant. And ever since that time, it's been a gradual decline. Now you see China, the GDP is going to overtake the United States in the next few years. It's already overtaken the United States in the PPP, purchasing power parity GDP. China's already ahead of the United States, as is the EU. And so U.S. is losing that power. You're seeing more and more trading outside of the U.S. dollar. So dollar hegemony is disappearing. The U.S. economic system struggling. We have an immense weight of the military, more than $1 trillion being spent on the military, 65% of our discretionary spending. If we have a financial collapse, which is, or another recession, which economists are predicting, at a time when we're spending that much money in the military and the world is tired of dollar diplomacy and starting to do trade without the U.S., it's very different from post-World War II, where the U.S. Yes. was so dominant. And so the next 10 years are going to be very fragile and very risky for the United States and for the U.S. empire to continue. That's why many are predicting this is the last decade of U.S. empire. So it's really, as you said earlier, Obama, and it's very important for people in the United States to be focused on these foreign policy issues, because the next decade, we're going to see U.S. empire decline, U.S. dollar dominance decline. And if we're not pushing for proper policies, it's very dangerous.
I fully agree. But there is also another dimension to it that is being totally ignored. And that is, as you mentioned, the amount of money that is moved from civilian economy into the military economy and how it's destroying the United States internally. It's not just the foreign wars that are killing people and destroying everything and the environment, but this military budget is one of the key elements that nobody in this campaign is talking about. Very few. And I think it's our task to bring it into the debate during this campaign. Peace movement should push for the question of military budget to be put on the discussion for everybody. I know Black Alliance has created a kind of questionnaire for candidates. Maybe we should kind of generalize that into a movement for all of us to put candidates on the spot to say, okay, what is your position on the military budget? How are you going to get rid of it?
Right. That's on the blackallianceforpeace.org website under the candidate pledge. And it's about cutting the military funding as well as demilitarizing police in the United States, you know, getting rid of the 1033 program. It's a whole platform around demilitarization and using our resources instead to lift people up. Now, one of the things that I thought was interesting, so Sergey Lavrov from Russia was able to attend the UN General Assembly, and he really talked about how the United States is trying to inhibit or prevent a multipolar world from developing. But do you see any possibility of stopping that train? It seems like it's already taken off.
I see it as something inevitable as things are developing today, but not without cost, because U.S. is not going to relinquish its hegemonic position. So they probably impose a lot of suffering and cost for that transition. But I see it inevitable. I think there's no other way out of this. I don't see any.
And the Pentagon also has issued reports that talked about a post-primacy era when the U.S. is not the dominant global force. And they of course, the Pentagon's recommendation is more military spending and more U.S. domination wherever we can do it. So it's hang on to that primacy era rather than face up to a multipolar world. So you're right. That is where the Pentagon is trying to push policy. And that's why, again, it goes back to what you said earlier. It's the responsibility of us, people in the United States, to stand up to this militarism. And, you know, we've seen a decline in lifespans in the United States. People's lives are shortening now for the last, 3 years? Mm-hmm. It's the first time that's happening. We see homelessness rising. You know, when we were in Venezuela, we couldn't find a homeless person. When in our city in Baltimore, we drive anywhere, we see homeless people. And so You're right. We are undermining our own economy, our own people. And it's a large part because we don't confront this issue of militarism.
That's true. And also, if you look at it from a global economy point of view, the so-called globalization, they created WTO to open the borders of all countries. And if you see, for a while, they thought they were successful. But everybody is going back to protectionism of the past now. Everybody after themselves. The U.S. is going back to protectionism, adding tariffs and everything, punishing China. You know, other countries doing the same thing. It seems that even on a global economy level, the project is failing. I expect some drastic, disastrous responses by the U.S. before the whole transition is complete, unfortunately.
So that was kind of what Trump spoke about at the United Nations, was what a post-global world would look like.
He says globalism is dead. Why? Because the U.S. is no longer in control. He didn't say that part, but that's the real reason.
Yes, exactly.
But what could a world look like if the United States were not dominant, if we had a truly multipolar world, if we actually had legal bodies that the United Nations were able to use its charter and its International Court of Justice to uphold the law? What is the possibility? What's the vision that we're working towards?
Well, I don't think all of us have the same, maybe we three of us share something together on this, but we should not forget, we are living still in the age of imperialism. We have to go deeper to the root causes of these things. When the British Empire collapsed, the world did not go to socialism or go to anything else, right? There was a new phase. There will be additional interests, big powers also. And we have to think deeper, in my view, personally, that we need some fundamental social reforms on top of these political reforms and foreign policy reforms.
What do you mean by social reforms? Define that.
The question of exploitation, the question of domination of capital, the banking system, they are powers on their own now, if you look at it. Governments are at the mercy of these transnationals. Governments themselves are not the main power anymore. This, we have to think in terms of economic transformations also, deep-rooted economic transformations. In my personal view towards socialism, it's not that after U.S. hegemony is done, the world is going to be hunky-dory. It's not. There's huge struggles still before us to guarantee that we do not face the same situation again with a different big power.
Yes. And in fact, President Evo Morales, when he addressed the UN, really called out capitalism as a problem. And yes, a number of leaders talked about the need.
So did Delcy
to go towards
Venezuela.
Yeah, socialism. They talked about the extreme wealth inequality where 26 individuals have the same wealth as the bottom 3.8 billion people.
26 people with 3.8 billion people's worth. It's just obscene.
Right.
But I think your point about imperialism still exists is so important, because we see in the United States, even among people who are progressives or left-minded politically, confusion about U.S. imperialism. We saw it in Nicaragua. We see it in Venezuela. People on the left confused about the rhetoric of the intervention. I see it in Hong Kong with the current protests that are going on there and people denying U.S. involvement. Syria, major problem with confusion. So if we had to really get people on the left to really start with that framework of no to U.S. imperialism. And when they see U.S. getting involved through the National Endowment for Democracy, for USAID, or through the CIA or other groups, even things like the Agriculture Department, I mean, the energy departments, I mean, it really pervades many agencies of government. But NED, USAID, and CIA are the big three internationally. We need to start with the question about U.S. imperialist involvement, U.S. getting into the business of other countries. And that's where our analysis needs to begin.
Yeah, true. And this is not just getting into the business of other countries like by military force. It's also economic penetration that we have to deal with. They are controlling the economies of these countries. At the whim of the president, they can immediately destroy an economy. George Soros is buying and selling currencies, bringing countries' currencies to zero level, driving them bankrupt. They can do it peacefully. I mean, we don't forget that the U.S. has killed in peacetime more than it has killed in wartime.
Depends what you call wartime. Yeah. It seems like to me we've been at war every year of my life, and I'm in my 60s. But
that's an important point, that these economic measures.
Oh, no question. It's not just the economic, also this democracy nonsense of NED. We need to start to wrap up this interview, but we covered a lot of ground here. What's the best way for people to follow the work that you're doing, Bahman, on these kinds of issues?
I personally prefer to go with our collective identity at this time, because it's the most important thing. I think we should strengthen the people's mobilization, and we should plan for additional work, continue our work, and strengthen and bring other forces into the picture. But I think we should also convince the activists that we need a strong anti-imperialist peace movement that is against war, not just because it kills or destroys, but because it is a source of inequality, is a source of racism, it's a source of all kinds of social ills that we have. And so long as imperialism exists, we're not going to have the life that we wish for the people of the world. So peoplesmoke.org is, I think, where people should refer to, and we should strengthen that.
That's good advice. And that imperialism is so tied to corporatism, which is tied to the corruption of the whole U.S. political economy and political system. So these are all tied together. I think you're making excellent points on how we have to confront imperialism, to confront racism and capitalism. Of course, Dr. King made those comments about the triple evils back in 1968 in his Beyond Vietnam speech,
67,
1 year before he was killed in 1968. We're all catching up with Dr. King.
And we should not forget here, we need to address the issue of media here too. That has become one of the main weapons.
Well, Bahman, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with us today.
I thank you. We are all together in it.
Yes,
we are.
Well, that's all for today. Let's go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want Because
The People Organized
Can Build the Kind of Future
We Want.
Brothers and sisters, the people together can overthrow the system.